started now. If you want to turn to go to chapter 35. As you're turning there, what I would like to do is get you to remember sort of where we've been. And the first part of that, I'd like to publicly thank Don Martin for substituting for me last week, and to Kitty and Corinne and Elizabeth for taking the time last time to tell you a little something about what happened on their trip to Japan. So, if you found chapter 35, look at the first verse. Who is speaking? Elihu is what I'm going to say. Don't know if that's right or not, but that's what I'm going to say. So Elihu is speaking. How long has he been speaking? How long has he been speaking?
Since 32.
Since 32. He has as much or more than any one of the three friends has, if you total it all up. And he has it all in one great big, almost uninterrupted chunk. And we've been talking some already about what he said, but that was a couple of weeks ago. Your assignment was to start at chapter 35 and continue reading through the rest of the book. And so I hope that that's what you've done. I want you to take a look for a moment at verse 2 and 3. And I want to use those two verses to make a very, very important point. And the very important point is this. If you had in front of you right now five good translations, you would probably have four different versions of that that would be different enough to be a little bit discomforting. And I want to make sure that you all know we have that problem going through here. We seem to have it a little bit more in Elihu's than we have anywhere else. We've had it a time or two. This isn't the first time you've heard about this. If you've been regular, you've heard about this before. But I want to show you this. Now, in the New Living Translation, verse 2 and 3 say, "Do you think it is right for you to claim I am righteous before God? For you also ask, what's in it for me? What's the use of living a religious life?" The Message says, Elihu lit into Job again. Has anyone ever lit into you? Or have you had the opportunity or necessity of lighting into someone else? Elihu lit into Job again. Does this kind of thing make any sense? First you say, I'm perfectly innocent before God, and then you say, it doesn't make a bit of difference whether I've sinned or not. That's not quite the same thing. And the differences get a little sharper at a couple places later. And I simply want to put you on notice for that. This is a part of Scripture where you are going to get less out of this if you read it in one translation. And you're going to get more if you read, say, a chapter or half a chapter in one translation, then read it again in another, then read it again in another. If you even go in three or four verse sections and read it in two or three translations and then read it again in two or three translations, you're going to get much more out of it. And I want you to know that. Let me come back. Here's the third translation. Do you think you can prove yourself upright and establish your uprightness before God by daring to say to him, what does it matter to you, or how does it benefit me whether I've sinned or not? Notice it sort of leaves out that whole first thought. Okay, so I want you to be aware of that. There's a little bit of a challenge walking through here. We're going to have a better chance of having a sense of what's being said if we can compare a couple of translations, or at least we know where a little confusion might be. Now, the next thing I'd like you to do, I want to come back to verses 2 and 3. I will do that later. I want you to take a look at verse 4, and I want you to try a little exercise with me. I'd like you to read verse 4, skip verse 5, and then read 6 and maybe a little bit into 7. You had a chance to do that? In my humble opinion, that reads pretty smoothly.
Yes, it's a interlude right there.
It's like you don't really need verse 5. That you got verse 4, you got verse 6, you just read them right through. So now look at verse 5. Does that seem to fit with the thrust of 4 to 6 to 7?
Well, one place it says they had long with his friends, and then he says 5 about looking to heaven. So it's a maybe a wider...
Well, here's what I think is happening. And I need to say this really clearly in here. I tried to do this really clearly in the first hour as well. It is my belief that having this occur as if it were a play is actually pretty close to saying you are recreating what the original conversation might have been like. Whatever happened way back when, I think it probably was an outdoor setting. You may remember in Jesus' day, people could come to dinner parties and all, as long as they just stood on the side and didn't say anything, they could watch all that was happening. And I think the three friends have come. I think Job is sitting someplace. His houses have fallen down. So, you know, he's got some shack to live in. He's come out and he's sitting there. And his friends come and sit with him. They start to talk. And I think the crowd has gathered to listen to all that's being said. And I think what's presented here could be produced as a play. I've said that before. But I think if they did, they'd sort of be reproducing or recreating what had happened originally. So here's what I think is happening. I think Elihu starts to talk in chapter 35, gets about 4 verses in, and suddenly something happens that makes him look up and says, "My goodness, would you look at that?" Read it again and see if that fits for you.
I see what you mean.
It's almost like he says, "Woo, would you?" And the moment he goes, "Woo, would you look at that?" What does everybody in the crowd do? I'll go look up as well. And what's the major thing that he sees? Mine says clouds. Does yours say storms?
Clouds.
Says clouds. Something about the clouds has distracted him. I think. I don't know this, but I think this. And here's what I want you to know. I'm going to go chase this rabbit first. What is going to happen is, as you move on in what he says, more and more things are going to happen that distract him to the point where he's almost totally distracted. That is laid on top of the things he's talking about. In fact, I think close to the end of the things he's talking about, I think he's shouting to be heard over the noise of the storm. Let me show you why I think that. The rest of 35, there's nothing there. Most of 36, there's nothing there. Until you get to verse 27 of chapter 36. Can you jump down to there? Verse 27 of chapter 36. What are the words that you see there?
Draws up drops of water.
He draws up the water vapor and distills it into rain. Now, I have a little tablet here, and I have the ability to highlight with color verses and words and phrases within verses. So what I did was, verse 5 back in chapter 36, I made that whole thing green, and the word clouds I made yellow. Over here in this one, I made everything green except the word rain was yellow. Come down to verse 28. What changes? So far we've had clouds. Now we've got rain. What do we have now?
It's pouring.
Suddenly it's pouring. Did you get up at 6:30 or 7 this morning? Did you try to walk outside and pick up the paper? What was it doing? It was pouring. Has it ever poured more heavily around here? You bet.
Yeah.
Right? There's a difference between rain and pouring rain. Right? Verse 29, I see the word clouds again, but then in the second line, what do I see?
Thunder.
What's the difference between clouds and rain and pouring rain and rain that's coming out of clouds where thunder is? There's a difference. Okay, and lightning's not yet. That's not till verse 30. What happens in verse 30?
Lightning.
Lightning. What happens in verse 32?
You can see it's lightning bolts.
Mine says lightning bolts. Some translations we heard in the first hour say lightning strikes. Does yours have something like that? Okay, what's the difference between lightning and thunder and lightning strikes and lightning bolts? What's the difference?
It's hit something when you...
Oh, it hadn't just hit something. What's it hit? It's hit something right there.
Right?
I mean, you're driving along, you see the lightning in the sky, you see the thunder, and it's way over there someplace, all right? It's raining or it's pouring rain. You got some lightning, you got some thunder and all this stuff, but all of a sudden the lightning strikes right there. right next to you. That's different.
That sure is.
Do you hear an escalation? Do you hear an increasing of intensity in whatever is going on in the weather? Verse 33, more thunder, and now for the first time he uses the word storm, at least in my translation that I'm looking at here. We okay? Chapter 37, verse 2, I see the word thunder, and in the second half of that phrase, the word rolls is used. Now they're personifying this as if it's God's voice. And that turns out to be really interesting.
Well, he says in 33 that the noise of it declares his presence.
Bill, this, I'm jumping ahead. We're coming up to the point where God speaks.
Yeah, but we're not going to do that yet. We're going to pretend we don't know that's coming, and I want you to pretend you don't know that's coming, but now that you've said
it. So what is happening?
Okay. The picture, I think, is happening, and I want to try to convince you that something like that is presented here, is he's trying to talk, and all of a sudden stuff starts to happen. The first time it happens, is, huh, would you look at that? And then right back, and he can go for almost a chapter. But then it starts to rain, and within just a little while, it's pouring rain, and then there's thunder. Now, remember, you don't get thunder without lightning, but thunder's mentioned first. What does that mean? The lightning's over there, and you can't see it through the dark clouds that have gathered. Then you see the lightning. That means the lightning is now closer. Then you see the lightning bolts. Now it's here. And then you see this. And Elihu, finally, he's had enough of this. He begins to interpret that for the people. He says, the thunder announces God's presence. This is your verse 33. The storm announces his indignant anger. Verse 37, my heart pounds as I think of this. It trembles within me. There are things that can happen in weather that get your adrenaline going. Lightning bolts are one of them. Let me tell you what the other one is. The other one is ice. I tried to drive on Wednesday morning. Even at 5 miles an hour, I had no control of my car. When I got to Woolridge and Walton Park and found 12 cars parked every which way, between me and US 60 and two police cars up there with the police going, go away, go away. I put my left tires into the grass in the median strip and I drove home at 5 miles an hour. I don't think I've had such adrenaline flow for a decade. Barbara said I got home and I was white and shaking. And that's right. I think if I'd made it to 60, I might have made it the rest of the way. I suspect that had already had some sand and had some ice. But you can't put sand down in anticipation of ice. The ice just covers it up. You got to come in after it's there. That was frightening. Let's keep going. The thunder of God's voice, verse 2 says in chapter 37, as it rolls from his house, from his mouth, it rolls across the heavens and lightning flashes where? Mine says in every direction. Now, when yours says to the ends of the earth, I don't think that captures it quite as well as in every direction. It strikes to the extremities of the earth, this one says. I don't think that's quite as good. He lets loose his lightning from horizon to horizon, lighting up the earth from pole to pole, left to right, up and down, everywhere. Verse 4, thunder. Verse 5, thunder. Verse 6, what you got?
Snow.
Mixed with
snow,
downpour, and rain.
Now, what do you call it when snow and rain are mixed?
Sleet.
I call it sleet. May not be quite right, but that's what I call it. Verse 9, what comes? There's something in the first half and something in the second half, and in a minute I'm going to have Barbara read it out of her translation because it's the best one we heard in the first hour. Mine says stormy wind and then says driving winds in the second half of the verse. Yes. Yours doesn't talk about wind? Barbara, would you read yours?
Yeah. Mine says, from the south comes the rain, and from the north the cold. It's almost like when it all hits right here in Richmond, Arizona.
Let me pause for a minute. When I did this in the first hour could not go with me. You guys are quicker than that, I hope. What is the trouble we face today? See? I told you right at the first 5 minutes that we started talking, I said, we are facing a problem this morning. What's the problem? Different translations will give such different wording. It's almost like you're reading something different. Okay, so here we are in verse 9. Mine says, the stormy wind comes from its chamber, and the driving winds bring the cold. I don't think that communicates very well. I like Barbara's. Rain comes from the south, cold comes from the north, and when they collide, what do you have? You got all kinds of weather smashing together. We experience that in Virginia sometimes.
That's the tempest, which...
Tempest is a great word. That's a great word. It's a step up from storm. Whirlwind, yeah. I have a picture taken from it's a neighbor of my daughter's. They took a picture out their front door. It shows houses in the grove, and up above, the sky is just going nuts. Mm-hmm. We've seen that about 5 times in the Richmond area over the last 2 years. And it never turned into a tornado, but it sure looked like it was just this far from doing that. Verse 10, what comes? That was Wednesday. And that's not the same as snow, and that's not the same as sleet. How does yours work there?
From the breath of God, His ice place is made.
Now, let me take a time out and try to make sure that you understand what I'm trying to get you to see this morning. Elihu is speaking all the way through chapter 37. And early on, he's talking about all these things having to do with Job and what Job said and all that. And then suddenly, this verse 5 of chapter 35, he gets distracted just for a moment. And then the end of the verse of chapter 36... he gets distracted a bit more, all by stuff going on in the weather around him. And by the time he gets into 37, it's almost nothing but what the weather is doing. Mm-hmm. You got a storm building like no storm that he's ever seen. And it's getting more and more and more and more. Mine says, God's breath sends the ice, freezing wide expanses of water, loads the clouds with moisture, they flash with his lightning, the clouds churn about, this translation says, at his direction, doing whatever he commands throughout the earth.
It almost brings to mind some of those movies, like the Ten Commandments or something, where you see all this going on in the sky and everything. The presence of God coming.
Now, he stops in verse 13 and 14, and he's left his early commentary stream. He's left his early stream. He now is simply saying, well, I can't ignore the weather. Let's use it. So he turns to Job and says, he makes these things happen either to punish people or to show his unfailing love. If we don't have rain, we die from lack of crops. But if we have too much rain, it can wash our houses away. Watch what happens in California. They got a drought and they still have houses washing down off the mountainside. Pay attention to this, Job, he says. Stop and consider the wonderful miracles of God. And that now echoes back to verse 7. Go back to verse 7, still in chapter 37. What does verse 7 say? I almost skipped over this in the first hour, and somebody spotted it and commented on it. What does verse 7 say?
Every person, so all can know his work.
There comes a point where everybody is so distracted they can't even do their work. All they can do is look at what the sky is doing, look at what the storm is doing. I have a feeling that there is a spiritual and an emotional parallel to everything that Elihu is talking about. You would know that better than us, I suspect. Yeah. But I think there is something physical happening that he's talking about. And what's happening physically would have parallels in other realms. And then in verse 15, almost anticipating what's going to come in chapter 38, he turns to Job and says, do you know how God controls the storms? Do you know what causes the lightning to flash from his clouds? Do you understand how he moves the clouds with wonderful perfection and skill? And then in verse 17 and through the rest of the chapter in New Living Translation, it sounds like all the storm goes away. Sounds like the whole storm goes away. Verse 17, when you're sweltering in your clothes and the south wind dies down and everything is still, he makes the skies reflect the heat like a bronze mirror. You don't do that with overcast skies. Verse 21, this is the one that's spectacularly different in different translations. This translation, we cannot look at the sun, for it shines brightly in the sky when the wind clears away the clouds. Here's that same verse in another translation. there are times when the light vanishes behind darkening clouds. Now, let me take a position. You read your translation and see. You should have elements of one or the other of those or something like that. Here's what I think is happening. I think for just a moment, the skies have cleared off to one side. And if that side is where the sun is, if the sun is low in the sky over there, what happens? It lights up everything underneath the skies over here. I had the experience one time of driving down Interstate 81. I don't know what I was doing over there, but I was by myself coming back from somewhere in Washington or Maryland. And there had been heavy overcast skies with rain and all this. And as often happens, I'm driving south. Everything's moving from west to east. It had cleared over here, and it was still low ceiling of thick, thick clouds. And the sun was low enough, it lit up everything underneath there. The trees to my left glowed in a color of gold that I don't think I've ever seen. I've seen it hinted at in pictures of aspen out in Colorado when the sun hits them in just the right way. And I think something like that might have happened. But I don't think it lasted. Because I think by the time you get to 21, it's more consistent with what happens in chapter 38. The light vanishes behind darkening clouds. Look back up to verse 19. This is another little moment of commentary in between all of this. He says to Job, here's all that God is doing. Verse 18 ends with, can you do that? And then verse 19, so, I think it ought to say, if so. If so, then teach the rest of us what to say to God. We're too ignorant to make our own arguments. Should God be notified that I want to speak? Can people even speak when they're confused? Now that verse 19 that we read, we're too ignorant to make our own arguments. This translation says, teach me what we should say to him, but maybe we better discuss this no further since we're in the dark. I think that's the better translation. I think there was a moment where the sun lit up things and he comments on that. And then he says, you know, God could have taken everything away and made the sky like a mirror. But he didn't. We're all back in the dark again. It's getting darker. It's getting darker. And then he finishes with words of praise to God. How you doing so far? Now, read the first two verses of chapter 38. What happens? God speaks to Job from where? From the whirlwind, from the storm. Mine says from the whirlwind. One translation, which I think is the better one, says from the tempest, because you need a big word for the storm that was breaking.
Just exactly. It's again, symbolically, it's exactly what Tom was talking about today. God's presence.
Yeah. And what does God have to say? Now, I want to pause for a minute. One translation says, verse 1, the Lord gave Job his answer. In your service today, if Tom Stocks did what he did in our service, he would have invited you to ponder which word or words Jesus emphasized when he spoke to the Father.
If you can.
The Father said, if you can, would you help my son? Jesus says, if you can, or if you can. And, you know, is the you aimed at the Father, or is the you aimed at all that? I want to pick that up here. He gave Job his answer. Is that God's answer? Or is that the answer Job needed? Or is it both? And what does that answer consist of? Question after question after question after question. Now, I want to pause there. I want to come back before we finish. I want to pause there. I want to go all the way back to 35 because we got caught up in what the weather was doing and in the build up to 38, and I wanted you to see that. Your assignment was to read this, but I'm not sure that everybody who read it would have spotted this sort of build up to that tempest. The storm grows from something little to bigger and bigger. Let's go back to chapter 35. He asks Job a question. And his question says, you said two things, and they can't both be so. That's essentially what he's trying to say. But look at the two things he claims Job said. The first one is, do you think it's right for you to claim I am righteous before God? Now, you've been in here in this study of Job for a while, and most of you have been pretty regular with that. Can I say that? Yeah. 3 months ago or 4 months ago when we started this study, could you have said this? Well, you could have, but you probably wouldn't have realized it. Right?
Yeah, mine says something very different from yours.
Well, that's the trouble we face. Okay. What does yours say?
Mine says, can you say you're more just than God?
No. Yeah, I don't think that conveys what's here. But once again, let me just stay with this. What's the basis on which I can say what Job is saying? What Jesus has done. And Job has figured this out without knowing what Jesus did. That's what amazes me. The second part, does it make any kind of sense? First you say I'm perfectly innocent before God, this is the message, and then you say it doesn't make a bit of difference whether I've sinned or not. Does it make a difference whether I've sinned or not? There's a whole bunch of people in the world trying to claim, you can't tell me what to do because nothing I'm doing affects you. It just affects me. Is that true?
No.
Did I misjudge?
He has said some things like it, but I don't know that Elihu is necessarily quoting him correctly. That's something I'd have to go back and look. But I think Job has asked, I have lived a life that's as right before God as I could make it. And I don't say that out of pride. I say that out of humility. But that's what I've tried to do. What difference did it make?
Okay.
Now, that's not the same as saying what Elihu is saying, but it's close enough that you can see how Elihu can get away with claiming that's what Job was saying. So let's just stick with that. When I sin, does it only affect me? Does my reaction to sin only affect me? Now, you don't know where I'm going with that second question.
What you're asking.
You don't know where I'm going with that second question. There are so many people who are claiming
your reaction to sin affects other people.
I think so. And I'm going to make an argument based on the newspaper over the last 2 weeks, the weeks that we've been apart from each other. There are people who are saying there are victimless sins and we shouldn't do anything about it because they only affect me. Human trafficking and all this kind of stuff is one of the places where they do this. If I go get drunk, it only affects me. Well, my sense is that's pretty easily falsifiable. No, that's not. It doesn't just affect you. But what's interesting is the reaction to sin. And the newspaper article was contrasting what's happening right now in Arizona with what's happening in Texas. And I didn't know this before I read the article, so if you haven't read the article, you probably don't know this. Arizona has budgeted hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to build more jails. And they're filling the jails faster than they can build them. And it's bankrupting the state to incarcerate all the people that they think need to be incarcerated. Texas has budgeted as much or more money to build prisons. And so far, this last big round of appropriations, they have not spent a cent of that money. They have not built more prisons. What they instead have done is spend something close to $200 million on programs within the jails to try to grab these guys and these people and help them understand what got them where they are, what can get them to a different place, and how much more desirable that place is. And it's working. These things are getting traction. They're having, is it recidivism? Is that the term that's used for that? The rates are falling faster than anybody would have predicted. And here's what the article said. The reaction of the state of Texas to the things that put people in prison is different from the reaction of the state of Arizona to the people that they're putting in prison. And look at the difference. I don't know exactly where to go, but it seems to me to fit with this. Let's keep going. Look down at verse 9. Still in chapter 35. When times get bad, this is the message. When times get bad, people cry out for help. They cry for relief from being kicked around. But they never give God a thought when God when things go well. They never give God a thought when God puts spontaneous songs in their hearts, when he sets out the entire creation as a classroom using birds and beasts to teach wisdom. People are arrogantly indifferent to God, unless, of course, they're in trouble. Does that remind you of anything?
Yes.
I see it
in the Bible. Does it remind you of anything in the Bible?
Me a little bit, too.
What's the book of Joshua? The bush of Joshua. What does the book of Joshua talk about? The filling of, the conquering of the promised land. How did they come into the promised land? They came in from the west. They crossed the Jordan River. First place they went was Jericho, and then they went from there. Remember that? So that nowadays we have songs that talk about crossing the river as a parallel for death. Right? Okay, what's the book of Judges talk about? They're in the land, all the threats are gone, and now they start doing whatever they want. And when they start doing whatever they want, they get in trouble, they cry out to God. God raises up a leader called a judge. The leader turns them back to God. They get out of trouble, and as long as that leader lives, or sometimes as long as the memory of that leader lives, which is maybe two generations or three, they're fine. But the day comes when they forget what the leader had done. Therefore, they forget God that the leader had taken them to. And all of a sudden, they go back in the cycle again.
It's a cycle.
That's what this sounds like. Here's my point. Some people try to explain what Jehu is doing. Elihu is doing. And they do that by saying he's speaking for Satan. There's enough that he says that doesn't fit, that doesn't work. And this is one of those places. What he says in verse 9 is pretty darned accurate. That's pretty close to right. The book of Judges tells us most of that. And there's enough other things that when he speaks of them, he's right. But he's not talking for God either, because there's enough he's saying that's not right. Okay, let's go back over to chapter 38 for just a minute. We said that when God started to speak, he begins to ask questions. How many questions does he ask? There are some pretty wise people who say he asks 64 questions. Wouldn't that be a nice number? When I count through in the translations I have, I don't get 64, but I do have to admit I get a number that's fairly close. It's maybe 68 or 69 or 70 by the time you add them all up. So somewhere around 64 questions. What do the questions deal with? They start out dealing with geology, creation, weather, land and sea, earth and sky, day and night, heights and depths, patterns of weather, heat and cold, wind, rain, snow. Astronomy, cosmology, how do the stars move, how do other things move. Psychology and neuroscience, especially verse 36 and chapter 38. Ecology and animal behavior, agriculture, domesticated and undomesticated animals. War and the use of horses in war, hawks and other birds of prey. And then you get to Job 40. Take a look at Job 40. Look at that first verse. Of 40. I think I've got this right. Let me take a quick look and make sure. Yeah. Do you see the pause? Mm-hmm. For the first time since 38, you get this little thing. Then the Lord said to Job, it's like God catches his breath, pauses for just a minute, and then digs back in. And this time when he talks, what are the questions? The questions are about the role of God in the affairs of men. And then he spends some time talking about Behemoth. And he spends some time after that talking about Leviathan. And oh boy, do the commentators go crazy trying to figure out what that is. I'm not suggesting I know. I will say that if you look closely, Behemoth appears to be a giant, powerful beast that lives on land. And Leviathan appears to be a giant, powerful beast that lives in the ocean. Some people say hippopotamus and crocodile. Some people say dinosaurs of one kind or another. Take your choice. Lots of speculation. There's a few who speculate that the beast on land and the beast on the, in the sea parallel the two beasts that show up in Revelation. I don't know that that's true. I don't know that that fits, but I invite you to entertain the idea. Okay? So, what's your assignment for next time? Read the rest of Job, starting with 38, and what you're looking at are the questions that Job asks, that God asks of Job. I would invite you to look for two reactions. If you were Job, would you have answers to those questions? And if you didn't have answers, what would you say? Number two, in those questions that he asked, how much would people of his day have known to say in response to those questions? And I think the answer would start with a V. Very little, they would have very few answers. How about today? What would we have? I think it would start with A. A very little bit more. I don't think it would be a lot more. I think it would be a very little bit more. Compared to then, it looks like we know a lot. Compared to how much there is to know, I think we're still pretty ignorant. Compared to what, from God's perspective. Now, at this point, I need my friend Jean Lloyd. Because she was in here today with an old study Bible that had two great footnotes. And the footnotes basically said, God is so infinite and so beyond us that it is not possible for human beings. We can know of his existence, but we cannot know him unless he chooses to reveal himself.
And he did.
I think that's the best set of words that I heard in the first hour today. How does God reveal himself? He's done it through his son, but Job didn't have that.
Probably
didn't have the Bible, because I think he's back with Abraham.
Creation, the storm.
That's why those words, it's like a textbook, a classroom book that creation puts in front of you. And with only that, Job had figured out a lot of who God was and what he was about.
In seminary, they asked us this question. And they said, think about you're on a deserted island or close to deserted, and there's some tribe that lives on that island that has not in, no, has no Bible in their language. Can they know God?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we sat there and argued that. You know, bottom line is,
the answer from Job is clearly
yes.
You may know him imperfectly, but what you see in Job is Job gets there. And then he doesn't have the confidence to stay there. He sort of falls back away. But he keeps getting there. Just based on that limited evidence.
It's a nice reminder of what Tom said today. You know, when he started climbing that ladder. We think we need the education so we can get a job and make money, which brings prestige, which brings power. And in reality, it should be the other way around. Mm-hmm. You know, it should be, and because I think we try to put, so often put God in a box because his infinite wisdom and power scares us.
Overwhelms us.
Yeah, and so we'd rather be able to figure him out.
If we let our knowledge of him fill us with pride that we know him, we are in trouble.
Right.
If it fills us with arrogance, we are in trouble. If it fills us with humble gratitude, it makes us useful.
Yeah.
You know what I thought? We are creatures. We sometimes forget that God's a creator. We're just part of the whole creation. How can one little creature understand God, who is the creator? I mean, it's just not possible.
We're out of time. I want to say one more thing. I did not think to say this in the first hour, so I'm going to have to remember to say this next week. I want you, as you read through what the questions God asked, I want you to imagine the tone in which the questions are asked. Are they asked in an accusatory, angry tone? Or are they asked with patience, with a little bit of a smile, a little bit of humor, a little bit of sense of, I take delight in my creation, and people built, created in my image are at the center of my love and my thoughts? Which way is God asking these questions? Coming out of this thunderstorm with the booming sound of God's voice. Don't forget, on the Mount Sinai, the people heard God's voice. And what's the next thing they said? They said to Moses, "You go up and find out what he wants. Come back and tell us, we'll do it all. But don't let us ever hear his voice again, or we will die." And here's Job and his friends, presumably, hearing the voice of God. For question after question after question after question. So my question of you is, as you read this, see if you can decipher or decide for you what's the tone that God is using. And I'll give you a little clue. I think God has a twinkle in his eye as he asks these questions. I think he is delighted in his servant Job.
The thunder and the lightning get his attention.
And I think we saw some false notes back there where Job needed some purification. Job needed some tempering. And I think Elihu is right when he says, I don't think we said this, God uses the suffering of people to rescue them from suffering. He uses affliction to get their attention, which is exactly what you're talking about.
He speaks to us in
And I just invite you to see if you can read the words and have it fit with God having a smile and a little twinkle in his eye as he talks to somebody he deeply cares about, his servant Job. Because I think most of the time when we read this and when we think about this, we assume he's yelling at Job. And I just invite you to give that some thought, Rusty. We're almost done.
Well, the thought I was just asking here was, he also uses it to teach
his friends.
He uses it to teach Job's friends.
Well, I think he does teach us through each other.
Okay, I think we're finished. I've kept you a little longer than I meant to, but I think this is productive. I will hope to see you next week. Let's have a word of prayer. Our Father, we thank you for your word, which gives us things to talk about that are sometimes as deep as this. I pray today that things that I have said are consistent with what you were trying to say. And I pray that you would take the things that I have said and use them in the hearts of each person here to bring to their minds the things you want them to understand and know out of this study. I thank you for your servant Job. I thank you for the example he sets for us. And I thank you for the revelation you have given us that sometimes even people who are walking so close to you still experience the suffering and testing that seems so often to come. I pray all of this in your Son's name.